This is another iRaw podcast.
And I found that thinking with animal studies, and I didn't recognize it as a distinct form for a long time. I got interested in this late 1990s. And I taught myself, as it were, animal studies. And that opened up the different stories that you can tell by focusing on the lives of animals in themselves, and not seeing these as just metaphors or substitutes for something else.
Welcome back to the Animal Turn podcast. In today's episode, we're going to be speaking about a concept that's really close to my heart, and that's urban animal history. Now, this is kind of the realm in which I'm developing my own work, and as you can hear in today's episode, I sometimes get a bit carried away. I'm sorry about that. It was just so much fun speaking to Philip about urban animal histories and some of our experiences in the archives that it was difficult not to. Philip Howell is a lecturer in the Department of Geography at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He is a historical and cultural geographer and has written about the regulation of sexuality in Victorian Britain and on relations between geography and literature. But for 20 years, he's been researching animal geography, focusing in particular on the place of the dog in Victorian society. And sometimes he enjoys writing about animals in contemporary society too. A couple of times in this episode, we talk about his book chapter on dog stealing, but somehow I miraculously forget to actually ask him about the details of that chapter. So to remedy that situation, I'm just going to give you a quick lowdown now. The chapter is in Animal Spaces, Beastly Places, and Philip unpacks how dog stealing became something of a profession in Victorian England, because as dogs became more prized as pets and family members, people were willing to pay really large sums of money to get them back. Philip uses this to discuss some of the often classed, gendered, and property entanglements of dogs in London, and it is an extremely interesting and fascinating read. Now, other than my mishap with asking about the book chapter, there are some minor sound disturbances in the episode, some just small popping sounds that seem to come up in the middle of the episode. They're not too distracting, but I just wanted to mention them here in case they do bother you. And other than that, I think the interview goes really, really well. But before we get into the thick of the episode, just a couple of announcements. One is we have two new blog entries up on the website. One is from me about an elephant I saw in Phnom Penh. It kind of got me started reflecting on these ideas of animals being out of place in cities. Another is by Catherine Oliver, where she unpacks the concepts of urban metabolism in more detail. It's a really great read, and I encourage you to head over to the website to check it out. Also, we're approaching the end of season 3. For those of you that have listened to previous seasons, we always end the season off with a grad review. So I'm currently looking for some grad students that would like to participate in the final episode. So if you've got an interest in urban animals, please send me an email at info@theanimalturnpodcast.com. And finally, just a shout to say, please, if you have the spot of time to leave a review, whether it's a star or a sentence or a thumbs up or whatever it is, I don't know. It goes a long way in terms of helping the podcast. And just like that, you have some homework, you have reading to do, and you have reviews to leave. So first listen to the episode and then go do your homework. Hello, Philip. Welcome to the Animal Turn podcast.
Hi, Claudia. How are you?
It's about to rain and pour here in Ontario. So everything's the sky. Wait, Ontario. I say Ontario like it's this massive place. In Kingston, it's about to downpour. So if you start to hear like whoosh in the background, that's the sky's opening up. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Everything all right in Cambridge, actually. We've had quite a nice day.
I would really like to come to Cambridge one day, but mainly just to visit your cows. I've been reading a lot about the Cambridge cows lately.
Well, they've only just come out onto the green spaces, so only a few days, 2 or 3 days. So they tend to get sheltered during the winter, but it's a sign of spring when they're in the fields.
And the cows, they walk around the city, the campus. The Cambridge is both a city and Cambridge, the university, is the campus. So they. Are they close to one another? Excuse my ignorance.
It's not really a campus university, so there are little bits of the university all over the place. But Cambridge has these they're called green corridors, and they sort of reach into quite far into the city. And some of the cow keepers, they allow their animals to graze quite close to the city centre. It's not like they're wandering past Starbucks or whatever, but they are a wonderful feature of our urban landscape for sure.
And there are no bylaws that restrict the cows from being. Sorry, this is just a personal interest of mine. Cities.
This is the UK. There are laws everywhere, so there are lots of regulations they have to follow, for sure. You can't just bring. Should you move to Britain? Should you buy a herd of cows? You can't just take them anywhere.
All right.
They're very, very carefully controlled where they can go and when they can go and the like.
I'm quite surprised that they're so close to the city. We kind of have this idea of cows not being, particularly in Western cities, we have this idea that cows don't belong in the city. And I think Cambridge and the Cambridge cows offer I saw this really great picture of people just sitting in the park and there were cows snoozing right next to them. And everyone, it just seemed very different, the idea that this was in a city.
Sure. But you go to other places in the world. I made one trip to India in my life, and there are urban dairies. You have cows right in the middle of the city on highway divides and the like.
This is why what you do is so important and interesting. You know, you're a geographer, but you're also interested in you know, urban animal history. And you look at cows in Cambridge and you look at cows in Indian cities like, you know, Delhi or Mumbai, and you start to say, okay, well, how these are distinct urban relationships, but something historically happened to manifest these relationships differently. And similarly, you know, whereas in my city, you don't see cows anywhere at all, unless it's with like an agricultural fair. So yeah, I just think it's really fascinating. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a geographer, but more importantly, how you became interested in animal history.
Sure. The geography question is easy. Like many people, you end up doing something that somebody gives you encouragement for and that you're good at, that you found it interesting. They're not always the same thing. You could be good at something that you're not very interested in. You could be interested in something you're not very good at. If I try and speak French later on in this interview, you'll just have to forgive me. It's not one of my strengths, but I'm interested in it. But geography was always in my blood, and I became interested in historical issues, a historian of sorts. By accident, really. That wasn't what I was good at in school, and I was much better at geography than I was at history. But in the end, I've become a specialist in historical geography, and actually in the last 10, 15 years in historical animal geography, if you want to get even more specialist about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the animals thing is a much more recent turn. Not the animal turn, but my interest in animals and in urban animal history and the like, that's relatively late on in my academic career.
So what were you doing before you got interested in animals and animal historical geography? Yes.
Well, there was a pretty consistent interest in the Victorians in the 19th century. That's my patch. That's the area that I feel most comfortable thinking about and researching, literature, culture, British history, but also with an interest in the British Empire. And I was interested firstly in Labour politics, and then I did my post thesis work actually on the historical geography of prostitution, of sex work, and the animals thing came. Honestly, it started out as a bit of light relief, even. What I now call, and I tell my own students, I call it a side hustle. And I quite like it. If there are graduate students out there, early career academics, then I thoroughly recommend having a side hustle, having something mm-hmm. that is different from your main area of work. And that side hustle became the main thing that I do, but it started off as a kind of light relief from the work that I was doing on the historical geography of prostitution regulation.
And that article, you said your, I think one of your first pieces was in Beastly Places, right?
Yeah.
I've got the book here somewhere. Animal Spaces,
Beastly Places.
Yeah. And you had a fantantastic chapter in there about dog stealing. Is that correct? Yes, I'm not getting my references.
No, you're completely right. And again, that was entirely accidental that I happened to run into Chris Filo, who's a fantastic geographer, fantastic person. I ran into him at a party, and I mentioned that I was thinking about writing about dog stealing, and he was just on the go with Chris Wilbert, putting together this landmark mm-hmm. collection on animal geography. It's one of two really great, they're still very, very cited anthologies of work on animal geography. So I was very lucky that I happened to run across Chris, and it is frankly, it's a sort of accident. I was always interested in animal welfare and not eating meat and things like that. But it was a very secondary concern. My concern was with people, with social justice issues, with questions of theory, and the animals were a long, long way from the forefront of my concern. So it's a surprise to me even now to think that I suppose if I am known to other geographers, they would probably associate me first and foremost with the animal geography.
Yeah, that's I've read a couple of your pieces, and this is how I came to know you. That's why I reached out for you for this podcast in this way, because I myself have an interest in urban animals, and I find a lot of your thinking and your use of historical methods for understanding urban animals really, really, really helpful. So maybe we could switch now to talking about why history is so important in trying to unpack or understand the urban. Before we start to bring in animals and think a bit about, you know, animal history, why is history such an essential part to understanding the urban?
I always want to combine this with geography because we have to realize that our history in the West is only a tiny, tiny fraction of people's experiences. And our experiences with animals, what we consider to be normal, you know, not having mm-hmm. cows in the streets, not having dogs in the streets, off the leash or not obviously pets. This to us, to most of us, is unusual. But to most of the rest of the world, this is normal life. And what we take to be normal and almost natural is something which is not historically very old. And my particular take on this is that most of the things we associate with normal animal geography, if you like, where animals are and also where we think they should be, most of those things have only developed relatively recently. And I'm a Victorianist. I tend to think everything changes in the Victorian period in the 19th century. It goes with the territory, but there we are. Everything changes in the 19th century for things like mm-hmm. pets, for the nature of city life, for the nature of urban history, industrialization, urban modernity. To me, there is a quickening in the 19th century, and animals are a part of that.
Understanding how we came to have cities that we have today, whether it's, you know, like we spoke about Delhi or Cambridge or Kingston, understanding how they came to be how they are today, for me, is inherently a historical question as well. And you point to the industrial age or the beginnings of it. And a lot of what we see today in cities, I think, I don't know. It's part of that. Although cities have changed quite substantially. Like I think of an Oliver Twist novel and I think about how you had smoke and factories and you've kind of got these tropes in your head about what a city looked like at that time. Whereas now you might not find those same kinds of things in a city in the same way. And this to me says, well, something, as you said, something has changed from kind of that 19th century to now. And understanding that seems really important if we consider that most of the human world currently lives in cities. So it's interesting. And what do you think history and geography bring to kind of understanding then the relationship between humans and animals, as well as animals and their world?
Mm. Well, the first thing I would say is that we're seeing those transformations now in other parts of the world. So massive urbanization, the springing up of cities, the almost total transformation of societies. And this includes things like pet cultures. We see in China the sorts of things that you might have seen in a slightly different register in the 19th century or even the late 18th century. So that's what we can learn. We can learn about where we are now, looking to what has happened in, say, Western societies in the past. But in relation to animals, we have a sense of where these things come from. And I'll give you an example in a second, pet food. We're emboldened to think about why those things sprung up in those societies at that particular time. What are the conditions for the emergence of something like pet food? And pet food is 1860. A guy called James Spratt, he saw dogs eating ship's biscuits in the streets of Liverpool. And the idea came to him that actually dogs could be fed a specialist meal. And dog food today, pet food, is $100 billion industry. Mm. And that is no older than 160 years. And that's an amazing thing to think of. Those things had their beginnings in the Victorian age, in a particular place at a particular time. And the idea that we should feed our animals, our pets, specialist diets, that is an extraordinarily recent thing. And for most of the world, this doesn't hold. Most of the world is only just learning to be marketed by the Spratts of today, the Ukanubas and the I'm trying to think of the dog food manufacturers, but they are being targeted by companies today, and those things originate in a particular time in a particular place. I tend to think the 1860s are a massively influential period of change for our relationships with domestic animals, not with other animals, wild animals, or those animals we think of as pests or vermin or working animals, but for domestic animals, the 1860s onwards is incredibly formative.
So I have two questions, but the first I'm going to just speak a bit about, so you made a comparison there between Chinese cities and you know, maybe cities in the UK. And I'm worried or cautious, I guess, in terms of when you make these sorts of comparisons, and then it sounds as though China is moving on what seems like a linear progression, or somehow the West has moved on this progression of this is how animal relations took place in the city. It naturally led to the disappearance of dogs, etc. And now China or Chinese cities are on this same progression. And I know that this is a critique that sometimes comes forward, in that other cities or cities that are not considered Western cities are viewed as being on the same trajectory, that somehow we're locked in place in terms of urban development. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's not unilinear, but we can see what's happening with the growth of pets, Western-style pets, I should say, worldwide. Mm-hmm. And there are other parts of the world where we're not seeing quite the same thing happening. And there are places around the world where we in the West can learn from what other countries, other cultures' experience are. So our notion of what a pet is extremely particular. Pets are owned by individuals or families. You know, they belong to small groups, to private groups. Whereas in lots of other places, pets can be collective. They can be, as it were, owned or at least facilitated by neighborhoods and neighborhood groups. They don't necessarily belong to individuals. And it may well be that we have to challenge not just the unidirectionality of how we think about our relations with animals, but also be prepared to think that there's a diversity of practices out there. And we in the West are not on the, you know, the advanced wing of what is happening. And we certainly need always to be reminded that, and dogs are my specialist animal, be reminded that most dogs don't look like our pets. You have a pet, you have a pet dog. Most dogs, in the nicest possible way, your dog and everyone else's pet dog of this kind, they're not normal in global terms. The normal dog is the street dog. Then they're not, it is not, there's nothing natural, there's nothing unilinear about this, but for whatever reason, a particular culture has taken hold in our societies, and it is that culture which is spreading to different parts of the world at different rates, different speeds, and different ways, and not absolutely not in a deterministic way.
Okay, great. So I see it's not a matter of saying this is the way these relationships will form, end of story. It's a matter of saying there's a particular culture, Western culture, that's been very effective at being spread across the world through a variety of means, and this manifests in a variety of urban relationships, one of them being a very specific type of human-pet relationship. Krithika did speak a little bit in my interview with her about kind of the differences between thinking about stray dogs, street dogs, and now what you're talking about here is also pet dogs. And she reflected a little bit on what got her interested in dogs was that actually someone from the Humane Society, I think it was the Humane Society, someone had shown up in essence saying, you know, this idea that the UK is the biggest animal lovers in the world. And this is how we need to take care of dogs, is we need to put them in individual homes, have them, you know, cared for in that way. Whereas for her, it seemed kind of jarring because that hadn't been her urban experience with dogs in the city where she was doing her degree, that actually dogs were street dogs. They came, there were these transient relationships with people, but it wasn't this matter of in order to belong, you needed to belong in a human's home, which is a really profound difference, I think.
Yes, and I'm very, very happy to give a shout out to Krithika. I read one of her articles quite late on in my own work, the work which culminated in a book about the Victorian dog. And it was really important because it was a reminder that that particular culture is a tiny, tiny little bit of the world. And it reminded me not to universalize and actually to see these things, the things that we do, the feelings that we have, the practices that we invest in, as pretty weird. From lots of people's perspective, and it isn't just, you don't even have to go as far afield as South Asia for this, or China. People in the Mediterranean, people in the Near East will treat animals in very, very different ways. Ways that we might be tempted to see as wrong, bad, worse than ours, cruel. But we need at the very least to reflect on what we do and to see where it has come from and to see the elements within it which can be very cruel. And part of my own work on dogs was to point out that the more that we coddle and cosset dogs and see them as belonging to the home, belonging to particular owners, it's property of owners, the more we prize them, the harder we make it for dogs in the street. They become strays, become abnormal. And you see a dog wandering around, you might not, if you were in Athens or something, you might not bat an eyelid. But if you were in Kingston, or if you were in Cambridge, then you might think that's potentially a problem for others because the dog might be a nuisance, it might attack others, and it might be a problem for the dog because you might think that the stray dog is suffering and should immediately be taken to a home and rehomed, when the truth of the matter is we have plenty of surplus animals and sadly all too many perfectly viable pets don't make it to the care that we lavish on the animals that we love. And for full disclosure, I should say quite early on in any interview, I don't have a pet. This is always a surprise to people. I don't have a pet dog. I love dogs, love cats, but I don't have a domestic companion. There's no chance of this discussion being Zoom bombed by cat or dog or parrot or snake or whatever.
Is there a reason you don't keep a pet?
I had a cat once, loved it. Sadly, the poor cat died quite early, feline leukemia. I still love that animal. I have the picture over my left shoulder. My wife loves dogs, we used to live in quite a small house and we never thought that was quite appropriate. We just moved to a slightly bigger house. And a dog is certainly a possibility. My wife would love a dog.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. Dogs have come up a fair bit in the interviews for this season, and I think perhaps unsurprising because they're some of the few animals I think that urban residents are maybe paying attention to in a pretty considered way in terms of the spaces we can create from them, whether we see what, you know, stray dogs, how they should be cared for, what policies are created for dogs. I've been looking a bit at the history of animals in Kingston, and an interesting thing is that dogs have their own bylaw in terms of how they should be managed and cared for. So I think dogs have a kind of elevated, we see dogs in a different way, I think, in Western cities. But What's interesting, so something I spoke to Nicola Delon as well, and he brought up the idea of pervasive captivity, which is kind of this idea that animals are captive in a variety of different ways in the city. So animals, pets to some extent, are captives to the home. And he's using captive in a much broader sense, not just, you know, in terms of, let's say, an animal in the zoo who can't move, but that also there are wildlife that are, you know, captive in the sense that they're reliant on urban resources. They can't really go elsewhere. And one of the points that came up there was, and it's a really difficult question to contend with if you've got a pet at home, is this the fullest life that animal could lead? And it's not an easy question to answer. Does a street dog live a richer life than a pet dog? Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent, but it's really an uncomfortable, but I think important question that needs to be asked.
It is. And I think there are very, very interesting correlates of the idea of captive. I captivated, you know, we're captivated by animals. Jody Berland has a new book on virtual animals, and we are apparently, as the internet generation, we're captivated by internet cats and the like. We're captivated by animal stories. We are captured by them. It isn't just, I think, non-human animals being captured by us. And I would put a stress on the fact that some animals have become dependent upon human settlement and the food that we inadvertently or deliberately leave for them. But they're also extremely active. They're adjusting to us extremely quickly. I sometimes think that we're the slow ones, and actually non-human animals are quick. We tend to think that memes are super speedy, viral, and all the rest of it. But actually, our cultural modes, our sort of cultural attitudes are really slow to change, when actually all around us, lots of animals are adapting to different opportunities very, very quickly. I don't know whether, presumably in Kingston, you have coyotes and you have lots of other animals that are quickly becoming synervic or commensal. And that poses lots of difficulties for us. In the UK, it tends to be slightly smaller animals, but foxes and badgers and seagulls have, in easily living memory, foxes especially, really only in the last 20, 30, 35, 40 years, have started to become very, very familiar urban residents. And the way they behave is very different. Whether you call that captured, captivated, I think, to me, that sounds like a slight nostalgia for those animals should be in a different place doing their natural thing and not feeding off Nando's cartons or whatever the heck it is. And I think we need to recognize the fact that animal geography, as well as urban nature, is extraordinarily dynamic, and we need to look around and see how things are changing and how we might need to change ourselves to accommodate ourselves to lots of these animal strangers, neighbors.
Yeah. So it is interesting that you call them animal strangers. And let's maybe go back in history. So you'd mentioned kind of domesticated animals in a Victorian city being your niche and expertise. Maybe you could paint us a picture. What does a city in England during the Victorian era look like? You're walking down the street, and what animals are you going to see? What smells are you going to smell? How different is this city? How much change are we talking about here?
Well, the obvious animal to concentrate on are the horses. And it is patently absurd to think that we have separated ourselves from nature, certainly from animal nature, with the expansion of cities in the 19th century, especially the great metropolises. Very, very obviously, cities are full of animals, full of animal the animal presence. They're full of horses, especially. And we have to wait until well into the 20th century before horses start becoming a less frequent sight. And they haven't disappeared even so. Horses are, they're draft horses, they're work horses, they're military horses, they're police horses. Horses are used routinely. And Ulrich Rauf has talked about, he has a great book called Farewell to the Horse. And he thinks of the 19th century as essentially the horse's final century as being such a ubiquitous animal. And there's a certain sort of elegiac quality to that. But we have to accept that animals like horses are in the streets all the time. Animals like pigs and sheep, they're in cities much more than we think. Before refrigeration, they have to be driven to the center of cities. They are typically slaughtered in cities, not just in particular sites that we call slaughterhouses, but all over the city. And you can find them all the time. The sights, the sounds, the smells of those animals is what would strike us.
Yeah. So you'd walk down the street, you'd probably be on, I don't know, a wooden boardwalk of sorts, and you'd have a horse-drawn carriage or cart come by you, probably having the remnants of another animal that's been killed slopping off the back, and you're smelling that, and the horse poops as they're walking by, and you look down an alley and there's a, I don't know, group of pigs that are munching on something, and you hear a rooster crow in the background, and this is part of what the city looks like? Or am I painting, is there too much happening on the little walk down the street?
Seems all right to me. I've watched a few too many Murdoch mysteries not to sort of start conjuring up that slightly. It's very good. but slightly bad CGI in these sort of exterior shots. But people have talked about urban historians, animal historians have written extensively about the not just the struggles between animals and humans for space, for resources, but the struggle between different kinds of human beings, people who have an interest in driving their animals, or pig keepers, small pig keepers who exist in the city. And the more complexities arise, the more opportunity for conflict there is between different groups of people. And in the end, it would come to seem extraordinary that your neighbor should be keeping a pig, or that a pig should be allowed to wander in the streets and be rounded up only at the end of the day. All those things are seen as become unusual. Some people have talked about the bourgeoisification of the city. That thesis can be taken a little bit too far, but a lot of these animal practices, a lot of these relations with animals do change, and they get eradicated as the city becomes more quote-unquote respectable. Animals like birds, for instance, I wrote something with a good colleague, Olya Petri, about birdsong, and we tend still to think, okay, birdsong, that's natural, but bird songs have been manipulated for centuries. The urban canary is you might wander into a tavern and there'd be a canary in a cage singing its heart out, and that's part of the ambient noise, that's part of the sense around of the city. And that's not a little bit of nature which has been just yanked out of the trees and shoved into a cage. A lot of these canaries were specially trained, produced in Germany or Russia, and exported for this particular market. And the songs that they sung were not necessarily the songs that they sung in the wild. And there is, we need to recognize that we have been part of the manipulation of nature for a very, very long time now, much longer than the idea of the Anthropocene, for instance.
That's fascinating because, on the one hand, we've got animals who in cities in North America and cities across Europe, or many cities across Europe, have disappeared from the city. They haven't disappeared, they haven't gone extinct necessarily, but they've now located in different geographies, generally, you know, factory farms, laboratories. They're not as visible as they once were walking down the street. You would have 200 years ago, or even 150 odd years ago, you would have walked down these streets and these animals would have been visible. They would have been there in a variety of sensory ways, horses, cows, pigs. But now they haven't disappeared. They haven't gone extinct. They're just in other spaces. And that's a geographical question and an historical question. How did this happen? How did these animals go from being really, and this is the focus of some of the work I'm trying to figure out now. Let's see. But how does an animal go from being a normal everyday part of an urban landscape to being conceptually removed in terms of even the imagination of the city, the idea of them being in the city is absent. But then you've got animals who I think are readily accepted as being part of the urban landscape. Birds, like you've mentioned, squirrels certainly here in Kingston. And they too have an urban history. How did they come to be in this space, and why are they still accepted, or relatively accepted in the space? And I was blown away when I read an article about squirrels in New York and how they were introduced as part of this kind of idea of what a leisurely city should look like, or what a park should look like. And they were introduced and originally died in massive numbers because people didn't understand what squirrels needed from an environment. They didn't have the right trees. They didn't have the right coverage. But humans really wanted squirrels. So they figured out which trees and things to have in the city. And now they've become, there's no one actually knows how big the population of squirrels is in New York City, which is just a fascinating thing. Because one without a historical look, you might just think, okay, well, squirrels, they were always there, and we built up the city around them, and they just happened to be there. Really important to see that difference.
Yes, I don't know whether that's Etienne Benson, but I learned the other day that he was interested in squirrels and their history, and I'm sure this is amazing. But it gets us to all of this. I think reminds us that animals weren't just shunted into particular spaces; they also moved into different spaces. They moved into niches and opportunities, even if we didn't see them. So I don't like, I mean, John Berger's great essay, Why Look at Animals, is regularly cited, but he argues that animals disappeared. They become not just virtual, but actually facsimiles of themselves. They become Disneyfied. They become images. They belong to the order of representation, not to the order of nature. I don't personally, it's a great essay and we can learn an amazing amount from his work, but I don't particularly like that view that animals have become virtual, or they've become electric, they've become digital. When even in our modern, very, very cleaned up cities, we're not very far away from animals. And lockdown has challenged that idea. It's shown that the animals are much closer to us than we think. I've just moved house, and Cambridge is full of muntjac deer. They're an invasive species, and we're not here a week, and I see a deer from my window. And we're not way out in the country. Muntjac are very familiar domestic animals now, and that's a very, very recent thing. Have they been captured? The word and the concept seems a little bit strange, and it seems to make animals, again, moral patients, not moral agents. You know, they simply are passive, when actually I think, like many other people, that we can recover some of that agency of these animals, even in these challenging conditions.
Yeah. I can't defend Nicola Dillon's thesis. I think his concepts of captivity were really really fascinating, and I think he was speaking about it in a much more nuanced fashion of in terms of just that to broaden our scope of what captivity might mean. So not to say that all animals are captive, but that in effect,
that's not meant to be critical. But one of the themes in historical geography of animals is that animals become increasingly enclosed, not necessarily captured, but enclosed in particular spaces, the home, the zoo, and so on. And that, I think, is best misleading.
Yeah, and also I think to the idea of disappearance is also confusing, because, and maybe again this is a geographical thing, but they've gone somewhere. Unless it's, of course, complete disappearance, where we're talking about extinction. And even then, that has a history and a geography. You know, wolves are a really good example here, I think, with thinking about urban animal history. You start to look at wolf history and you realize how the creation of cities, particularly early cities, relied on pretty violent campaigns against wolves, you know, where bounties were set out for how many, you know, wolf pelts you could bring back, not because those were inherently economically valuable, but because wolves were seen as counter to, I guess, the idea of what a modern city should be, but also counter to kind of some of the economic goals of the city itself. And for me, what's starting to come up here is when you start to look, we've tended to tell urban history very much from a human perspective. This is how the city came about. This is what many humans have experienced. And even then, we've tended to focus on, I think, very particular humans and their experiences of cities. But when we start to pry open species a little bit more, and we start to say, okay, what have wolves' experiences been? What have cows' experiences been? What have dogs' experiences been? And deer? Then like a whole array of stories start to open up, a whole mess of trying to understand cities as dynamic places becomes available to us.
No, I agree. And that's part of the excitement. And I should say that I started off thinking about animals, their history and the city, really as a, it's not really defensible, but I, at best, I would call it a kind of jeu d'esprit, but I wasn't super serious about it. I'd seen other people talking about animals as actors, as agents, and thinking about animal geography. And I'm afraid this is not very honorable, that I thought, well, I could do that without too much trouble. And I discovered, to my pleasure, but also chagrin, that it was much more interesting, much more difficult, much more challenging, and theoretically intriguing than I ever imagined it to be. I'd started off thinking this was essentially a kind of cultural, historical geography. And I was interested in questions of things like public and private space. This is the dog stealing material. I was interested in class. I was interested in gender. I was interested in questions of urban regulation and the like. And dog stealing fit that bill, but I wasn't particularly interested in the animal itself. And I discovered during the course of my research on dogs, I discovered more of the animal turn and more of the, I had to unlearn certain kinds of historical and cultural habits, I suppose. And I found that thinking with animal studies, and I didn't recognize it as a distinct form for a long time. I got interested in this late 1990s. And I taught myself, as it were, animal studies. And that opened up the different stories that you can tell by focusing on the lives of animals in themselves and not seeing these as just metaphors or substitutes for something else.
So yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It's kind of hard. Sometimes even when you read an animal history, the animals and who they are as subjects seem to be absent. You'll read an entire chapter about, you know, I don't know, roosters in the city, but somehow it'll all be about how roosters impacted human lives, and very little about what the changing landscape or changing urban environment meant for the roosters. And this maybe brings us to one of the challenges of doing an urban animal history, or actually any sort of animal history, is how you understand animals as subjects in historical records. So in previous seasons, we've spoken a bit about ethnography, the ability to watch animals, to, as you said, unlearn some of what we've been taught about what they're doing, but to also just be open to observing and watching and learning from animals. But this becomes much more difficult when you're dealing with a document that's 200 years old or diaries or whatever it is. So how do you, especially if these kinds of ideas of animals being subjects are only starting to emerge now, becoming more concretized now, so how do you see animals as subjects when you're doing this kind of work, when you're in the archives?
Well, I think there's a strange suggestion that just because, let's say you're reliant on textual archives, then there is no trace of the animal at all. It's difficult to recover any lives, and the lives of the poor, the lives of the marginalized, the lives of women, the lives of the most sort of isolated members of the community, the lives of disabled people, the lives of differently abled people. It's difficult to recover them when actually the archives are sort of largely set up to remember public kinds of history, and that tends to be more privileged actors. But it's not impossible. And I'm thinking about the ways in which we can illuminate the lives of more downtrodden, more marginalized people by thinking through and recovering the lives of animals in the archives. It's not the only way. Mm-hmm. People like Etienne Benson will point out that there is an animal archive in, you know, whaling records, we have a record of where whales were, what they did, how they behaved, what kinds of communities they were part of, which are not negligible. We don't have a diary of a whale. We don't have that sort of direct access. But even then, that access is not completely direct. No one who works in self-writing will pretend that a diary is an automatic window into somebody's individuality. Even a oral history that's been written down, it cleans up what people say, and the traces of that encounter are somewhat lost. So it's not, I think, qualitatively so extraordinarily difficult from what historical scholars do. It has its own specific challenges, but I don't like the idea, and it sometimes comes up in animal studies. Kerry Wolf has been called out a little bit for this, that you know, because it's history, that means it's basically in hoc to the humanities and to humanist ideas, and that in itself, that means that the animal can never be found, that you can never say anything about the animal, purely because it is the past, and your access to the past comes through documents and other archival data. And I think that is too despondent, and I don't think it does enough justice to the work that people have done in animal history, but also in animal studies literature that has a sort of rather wider historical scope.
So you could look at a document like the whales and the whaling. I mean, people have done this as a way of showing how populations of whales have changed considerably over time, how, you know, there were many, many more whales, and this is part of their story as a population, as a group. Whales' numbers have declined. So this does give us a way of understanding whales and their worlds. And I suppose what you're hinting at here is also that when you look at this information, whether it's contemporary or historical, it's the lens that you're putting on, it's the goggles that you're wearing when you look at it. How do you see the animals in those documents and in those numbers, not just as commodities or as things, but as subjects? Do you make use at all of, I guess, so your focus is on dogs, and quite a bit of research has been done on dogs and how they experience the world. Do you make use of any of that kind of contemporary research about dogs and how they experience the world to understand the historical documents you're looking at?
I don't think I do. I could bluff it and say that I've learned some things from it, but I have read some of the ethological literature and some of the rather wonderful work that's been written, especially on dogs and how they perceive the world. John Bradshaw is the go-to person for thinking about the lives of cats and dogs, anthropozoology. But I probably haven't made enough use of that material when it comes to historical work, if I'm honest. Mm-hmm.
And perhaps before we go to your quote, we've been speaking at quite, I think, a big level here about urban animal history and, you know, trying to understand, one, the significance. I think we've spoken about the significance of animals and understanding cities themselves, that they've contributed to the city, that they've shaped the city, but in turn that the cities have shaped them, that those are dynamic relationships, both across time and across space. And I think we're learning now that looking at historical documents doesn't preclude looking at animals, that animals are present in history. It's a matter of just opening up our vision to seeing them. But before we go to your quote, do you have maybe a tangible example that could, you know, something that you've found in your work, a story that really captivated you that you thought was funny, something that, anything, just, if you could paint us a little bit of a picture, an urban historical anecdote, something from a newspaper or I don't know, whatever.
Yes, that's interesting. That's put me on the spot. I I do come back to the dog stealing material, and I love the fact that there is you have this window into people's lives. This is what I liked about thinking about dog stealing way back. And I was in the British newspaper library at Colindale. No longer there. I'm sad about it. It was one of the great places that I always loved working. But back in those days, you used to have to, the only places you could look, you could search newspapers electronically, digitally, was at particular terminals. And one of them happened to be in the British newspaper library at Colindale. And I'd finished what I was doing for the day. And rather idly, I wanted to check whether there was any material on dog stealing. I think my wife had been reading a book on Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and the whole story about Flush being abducted was part of it. So I'm trying to reconstruct what I was thinking. And I discovered that there was plenty. And this was such a revelation to me, because I wasn't looking. I wasn't looking for particular things. I was just trying to be alert to the chatter, the trace, whether there was enough in something as straightforward as the Times newspaper, whether there was enough there that you could, as a historical scholar, that you could get to grips with. And that I loved. And I'll just develop that a little bit. My favorite day in the archive ever was sitting with my friend David Beckham and going through Dog Enthusiast magazines, because I was interested in dogs in the First World War. And and that's my favorite ever situation, because when you're with people who are enthusiastic about something, you know, whatever it is, it could be stamp collecting, it could be, I that sort of reflects back on me. It wouldn't necessarily be something I'd go out and do, but I'm enthralled by their enthusiasm. And the thing about enthusiasts, people who write letters to fancy dog magazines, hobby magazines, that they are, in the nicest possible way, they're very imbalanced about priorities. They're very interested in certain things. And you just can't help but love it. And that was archive gold, as another of my colleagues, Fran Moore, often talks about it. I could read this stuff sitting in that wonderful reading room, and I knew which bits were going to go straight in the article. And they were making me giggle and laugh because people are just so, they're just so incredibly enthusiastic. Dog people will tell you about their dogs. And it's not necessarily my cup of tea, but you can't help but be entranced by the passion that people put into that. So this is a roundabout way of saying that archival research can be an amazing amount of fun. It can be really traumatic, but you can sit
traumatic.
Well, it can though. There are really terrible topics. You know, I was reading about. Yeah.
I was just thinking about you being an archivist. The trauma of trying to find this one piece. No.
Yeah, indeed. But the archives can be places of great, you know, passion and fun and enthusiasm. Mm. It's what I miss, not being able to be in the archives at the moment. And I long for those days to return when it is pure accident and it's pure serendipity. There is training, there's detective work, but there's also just, you know, dumb luck that things just line up and they spring into play.
Yeah. So
it's not really a funny anecdote exactly, but I do love that work. And even in a topic which is potentially, you know, always potentially serious, you're talking about the lives and deaths of animals often. Then there are things that they get you in a way that makes you glad that you're a scholar.
Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for sharing that. So I enrolled in my PhD to do animal geography, and I never in a million years thought I'd find myself in the archives. And I think as you were talking there, I was grinning ear to ear because I am now captivated, brought it up again, by the archives, because it was a small class assignment I was given to create a walking tour, and I decided to do a walking tour about cows in Kingston, and it was like being Indiana Jones. You were sitting in there, and it was just amazing. There was so much to find. I didn't think I would find anything on cows, and I found, and I've turned it into my whole thesis now, because there's oodles and oodles. There's tons to look at, and I think for me, any animal studies scholar, whoever they're looking at, whichever animal they're looking at, wherever they're looking at, I think a trip to the archives is normally just an enriching thing. I think, and you know, that's broader than history. Like if you're trying to produce a historical paper, it's one thing, but I think anyone doing animal studies, if they're interested in the species of the animal or the place they're looking at, a trip to the archives, one, to experience the joy of being in them, but two, I think if we take animals seriously, we need to also take seriously that they have histories that are worth understanding, which is just great. Okay. Let's switch to your quote. I think.
Sure.
Do you have it?
I cycled through several, and then I realized that they didn't have to be for my own work. And this is good. I couldn't quite find something which I thought your listeners would be particularly interested in. So I'm going to give you a quotation from Michel Foucault, who is not an unblemished source by any means. But I liked this quotation from an essay which is called in the English translation, The Lives of Infamous Men. Men shouldn't be taken to be just men, but that's what the essay is called, The Lives of Infamous Men. And Foucault is thinking about the, for him, really drastically asymmetrical relationship between the state and its authorities and people who get caught up in the net of power, these unfortunates who end up in madhouses or in prisons or whatever it is. And Foucault speaks of, and this is the quote, these lowly lives reduced to ashes in the few phrases that have destroyed them. And he goes on to say, I undertook to know why it had suddenly become so important in a society like ours to suppress, as one stifles a cry, smothers a fire, or suffocates an animal. Why it was so necessary to suppress a scandalous monk or a fantastic and inconsequential usurer. He was interested why these people ended up in the archives, being interrogated about how bad they were and why. Mm. And he compares the action of power. He uses two metaphors. One I just read out, smothering a fire or a cry or an animal. The French, and you'll have to apologize for this, is comme on étouffe un cri, un feu ou un animal. So, étouffe, why one snuffs out or stifles. And I like the way that these people, these small and lowly lives, and there is a pun between infâme, infamous or insignificant, and infime, small. Insignificant is much better, I think, than infamous. But why these poor lives, and this is all you know about them in the archives, why it was necessary for the state to smother them, as if you would smother an animal. And Foucault uses another metaphor in the same essay. He says that the power that authorizes them, makes them, and enjoins them to speak, it swipes them with a blow of its claws, marqué d'un coup de griffe. And again, apologies to French speakers.
Sounds perfect to me.
Life of the poor. You know, that's what power is for Foucault. You know, it's the people who end up being swiped are animalized, and the people and the power that swipes them is like an animal. Coup de griffe. That has stuck with me, because these small lives, and animals' lives are small, but so are the people who get sort of caught up in this play of power. So, and Arundhati Roy, the novelist, talks about the whisper and scurry of small lives. So what we're dealing with in animal history and animal geography and animal studies are lives which are coded as insignificant, lowly, unimportant. They don't really matter. But part of our job is to make them matter. Not to rescue them or recover them, but to make their lives, their presence in history a thing. You know, to actually acknowledge them. And I like that.
For sure.
About that that particular quote. Sorry, I went on.
No. I could probably speak to you for another whole hour just about Michel Foucault, because I think his ideas with regards to power and how it operates are really generative to understanding human-animal relations. But he used animal metaphors throughout his writing. Animals were kind of dotted throughout, yet he never ever, he called on and disrupted a variety of different things in our societies that we normalize, right? Whether it's gender and how gender is normalized, whether it's, the policing structures, surveillance, he called on all of these subtle things that we take for granted in our society that really structure our lives. And he was very in tune with calling them out. And obviously he can't be, none of us can look at everything and see everything. You know, he's not a god. He's just Michel Foucault, one of the best philosophers, but he couldn't see everything. But I'm still very surprised that the human-animal divide wasn't something he unpacked more. But still, I think his ideas of power and how things are normalized, and how even in his own writing, as you've pointed to there, how animals are normalized as being insignificant. If Michel Foucault were alive today, and I think you were to say that to him, he might have to look at it and say, well, why is this taken for granted? Why are animals' lives being seen as insignificant, a taken for granted thing? And then it would be worthwhile to study and research and understand. So
sure,
thank you. It's a great quote. Do you use Michel Foucault in your writing?
I do, but with a lot of caution. The point about using Foucault's work is that it isn't just off the shelf, and you find yourself arguing with Foucault. And Foucault's neglect of animals, like his neglect of women, frankly, is something that it doesn't invalidate the theoretical approaches, the various theoretical approaches that are involved, but it does prompt you to go and think through what that approach might mean if you took, in this case, non-human animals seriously. And lots of people have done that, particularly in the area of biopolitics. So lots of people have extended Foucault's very anthropocentric notion of biopolitics and extended that to non-human life in very, very good ways.
Yeah. And I think I think Dinesh, I've got the book here, Dinesh, Matthew Trulu and Dinesh, Joseph Dinesh, Dinesh Joseph Wadiwal, there you go, I'm busy looking at it. They released the book on Foucault and animals, where I think some of this conversation is starting to happen. But it's interesting for sure. And he, and when it comes to history, I think there's some controversy as well. And he's definitely interesting for understanding. But he, in speaking about urban animal history and how to do it, his ideas of genealogy and archaeology are also potentially useful in trying to understand the deer lives and the bear lives and the wolf lives that we were speaking about earlier.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, we're wrapping up now. So before I say goodbye to you, I just wanted to find out what you're working on now, and if folks are interested in what you're doing, how they might get in touch with you.
Getting in touch with me and my work, I have a website. I don't do Twitter or Insta or other things. I don't tend to blog very much, but there are things that people can find without paying for it. Probably the easiest thing, if you type my name and put CAM77, Charlie Alpha Mike 77. 1997, then there's a piece that I wrote for an alumni magazine, Cambridge Alumni Magazine, CAM. That's a reasonable way to start. I've tried to write in a more, in a less exclusive way, a more public friendly way. And I think that's a place to start, I guess. If they want to contact
me,
email me. Yeah. Sorry.
Is this your piece where you've got dogs and photography and you've got the images of?
Yes.
It's really a great. Well, a great piece. I enjoyed reading it so much.
I don't have a dog. Otherwise, I'd have my portrait with a dog by a really excellent portrait photographer. And that's a shame. But you just have my words. But there's some beautiful pictures of some of my colleagues in Cambridge and their amazing dog.
Yeah, it's a great piece. I'll make sure I share it in the show notes. And sorry, you said if people want to touch base with you, it's either via your website or?
The easiest thing is email, I suppose. I wrote a book on the history of the Victorian dog. That sounds very niche, but I'm very, very grateful to the excellent publishers, University of Virginia Press, and they did a beautiful job. I was so grateful to them for shepherding that particular monograph through to the end.
Are you going to continue working on dogs now? Are you working on an additional piece with regards to dogs? Or
I would love to, but I'm not particularly at the moment. So I've written a couple of pieces with one of my graduate students, and I really enjoy collaborative writing now. Her name is Alana Tavis. She works on coyotes in U.S. cities. But we've written a couple of pieces on media stories about animals. Part of this is lockdown, and there's a limit to what we can do. But it's a way of exploring contemporary cities, so it is less historical. We wrote a piece called The Curious Case of the Croydon Cat Killer, and we're using this, the media story about a presumptive killer of pet cats, to talk about the reasons why we think that certain things, certain lives and deaths in the city are okay, normal, and some of them are grotesque and monstrous. So we use that piece to talk about cats, pet cats, but also to talk about the predation of cats, of wild birds, but also about foxes and human predation. So it's a way of thinking about contemporary urban biopolitics involving humans and animals. And the second thing, and it's related to this, is a piece on horses in the Black Lives Matter protest. So this is coming out in June, I think. And it's a sidelight on the BLM protest by thinking about how what the role of the horse historically has been in racially divided societies. And in one sense, the horse is a sort of adjunct of authority, the police horse, the master horse, and horses have been used for slave catching, terrible subject. But in some ways, the horse is a kind of prop to white supremacy. But on the other hand, the horse can be a kind of a sort of ally for performative protest, as we've seen in North America, certainly in U.S. Cities. So it's a way of thinking about animals, but also a way of thinking about race and kind of racialized biopolitics. So those are the two things that are most recent. But nothing on dogs so far. I'd love to return.
It sounds fascinating. I mean, if you're looking at policing, policing and policing animals, you know, thinking about dogs, horses, and police, it's definitely, you know, how animal populations are used to manage a variety of populations, whether it's other animal populations or other human populations, I think. And what do these animals, the police dogs and the police horse, how do they become police dogs and police horses? What processes do they have to undergo? yeah, you know, how they're used as both technologies, but also as their beings. And for me, that's something I always struggle with, is to just to also remember that they are also there, but they're caught up in these really big, big battles that are going on in our societies. So really fascinating. I look forward to seeing it. June is not too long away, so I'm really excited to see that. And I'll make sure to share it when it comes out. But thank you so much for your time today and for being so generous with your thoughts and ideas. And it's been really wonderful talking to you today.
Thanks, Claudia. I normally hate talking about myself with a passion, but talking to somebody who knows the field and is interested in animal studies, I really enjoyed it. So thank you for the opportunity and the invitation. And there are so many really, really good animal geographers out there. There are some really, there's some fantastic animal history out there. If people are thinking about embarking on this kind of work, then it's a really interesting, challenging field. But a lot of it is, there are lots of treats in store, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's amazing. Thank you for all the work you do.
Sorry, I said treats. I hope I'm not waking your pet dog up.
Luckily, I've got the headphones in, so he's not hearing the T word. The T word is better than the W word. If I say that, then everything's going to go bonkers. But no, thank you again so much. Welcome to the Animal Highlight. Now, I knew when I started this season on urban animals, I simply had to have an animal highlight that focused on squirrels. So when they came up in the beginning of the episode with Philip, I did a little dance because it was the perfect excuse to do an animal highlight on squirrels. I cannot begin to tell you how enamored I am with squirrels. I could watch them pick up nuts, bury them, and pat the ground all day long. They're just so fun to watch. And it turns out that the relationship with finding and burying nuts is really fascinating and intricate. So a single squirrel can bury something like 10,000 nuts in an autumn season. And the reason they do this is because squirrels don't hibernate in the winter. So they're literally squirreling away food for the winter. But where it gets really, you know, just mind-boggling is that of those 10,000 nuts, they're able to find something like 4,000 of them again. And this isn't in a small little area. So it's not like, you know, one squirrel has buried 10,000 nuts in a single backyard. No, it's an area the size of 5 football fields. So they're burying their nuts all over the show, which is why they're called scatter hoarders. But the way in which they find them involves their memories and a couple of really interesting memory strategies. One of them is that they cluster their nuts together. So if they've got peanuts, they always bury their peanuts in the same area. If they've got some hazelnuts, they'll bury their hazelnuts in roughly the same area as well. This way they know that, if I feel like a hazelnut today, I'm going to head that way. But if I feel like a peanut, I'm going to go the other way. And on top of that, they also use landmarks. So they'll remember if they've buried their nuts, you know, close to a bench or close to a tree stump. And this is how they then zone in on this really large area and figure out where they left their nuts. And it's not just the burying of these nuts that's interesting. It's the stealing of nuts too. And I don't know if you know this, so they are really, really clever at watching other squirrels. And something like a fifth of squirrels, they don't forage their own nuts. They instead watch where other squirrels bury their nuts and steal them. So let me explain. You've got squirrel one grabs a nut and they run off into the field and they start digging a hole to bury the nut. Squirrel two is sitting there sneakily watching them bury the nut. And when squirrel one runs away, squirrel two comes in, takes the nut and hides it somewhere else. And sometimes squirrel one is aware that squirrel two is watching them. So what they do is they don't bury anything. They lie. They deceive squirrel number two by pretending to bury something. They pat the ground. They say, yes, I've put a nut here, and they run away. And squirrel two swoops in to steal, finds nothing. But while they're distracted, squirrel one runs somewhere else to bury their prize, which just the level of thought that goes into that. That's a squirrel seeing another squirrel, recognizing that squirrel's intention of stealing their nut, and then deciding to, you know, deceive them and run somewhere else. It's an incredible thing. And here squirrels are all about the city watching, you know, we could watch them do this anytime, which is just, of course, if they're in your city, which is just amazing. Some other cool facts and things you might not know about squirrels. So a squirrel nest is called a dray. They're actually pretty distinguishable. They look like large, messy nests. And they have their babies in these drays. And when the babies are born, they are blind and hairless. And the mom gives them milk for the first couple of weeks. And they stay in there until their eyes open and they get some fur and they can run about. If you're interested in a paper about kind of the relationship between urbanization and squirrels in the United States, definitely check out Etienne Benson's The Urbanization of the Eastern Gray Squirrel in the United States. Now, the reason this is interesting is a lot of people kind of think, oh, squirrels just naturally, you know, in quotation marks, naturally belong to urban spaces or to parks. But in fact, they were introduced. There were these ideas of squirrels kind of representing nature, and their introduction to parks wasn't always simple. You know, there's a whole ecology around squirrels and what they eat and the types of trees they want to live in. And there was some ignorance as to what squirrels needed. So the size of the squirrel population in Central Park now is just absolutely massive. And trying to think about what the history of those squirrels are and how they came to be there is, I think, a fascinating question. And another place to just go and watch squirrels and just marvel at how intelligent they are and how quick they are at problem solving, you should check out Mark Rober's YouTube channel. So Mark Rober is a science educator. He actually used to work for NASA, and he does a whole range of just brilliant YouTube videos. He's the type of guy you watch and you think, oh man, I want to have a beer with him. He just seems like someone you want to be friends with. And he does these really cool videos, and one of them is looking at squirrels, because these squirrels keep stealing seeds from him, and he develops an entire maze for the squirrels to get to nuts, and they figure it out, and they do it in absolutely incredible style and flourish. And on top of that, Mark also starts to explain some fascinating features of squirrels, such as why they're always able to land on their feet. And I'll give you a hint, it's got to do with where they position their eyes and how they use their tails. But I'm not going to tell you anything more. You need to go and check out the channel. It's well worth the visit. Go watch those videos and just marvel and appreciate how awesome squirrels are. A big thank you to Philip for being a wonderful guest. As always, a thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics Apple for sponsoring this podcast, to Jeremy John for the logo, and Gordon Clark for the bed music. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hurtenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.